Chapter 14. From Al-Suwarqiyah to Mecca. We have now left the territory of Al-Madinah. Al-Suwarqiyah, which belongs to the Sharif of Mecca, is about 28 miles distant from Hijriyah and by dead reckoning 99 miles along the road from the Prophet's burial place. Its bearing from the last station was southwest 11 degrees. The town, consisting of about 100 houses, is built at the base and on the sides of a basaltic mass which rises abruptly from the hard clay plain. The summit is converted into a rude fortalice. Without one, no settlement can exist in Al-Hijaz, by a bulwark of uncut stone piled up so as to make a parapet. The lower part of the town is protected by a mud wall with the usual semicircular towers. Inside, there is a bazaar well supplied with meat, principally mutton, by the neighbouring Bedouin, and wheat, barley and dates are grown near the town. There's little to describe in the narrow streets and the mud houses, which are essentially Arab. The fields around are divided into little square plots by earthen ridges and stone walls. Some of the palms are fine-grown trees, and the wells appear numerous. The water is near the surface and plentiful, but it has a brackish taste, highly disagreeable after a few days' use, and the effects are the reverse of chalybeate. During our half-halt at Al-Suwarqiyah, we determined to have a small feast. We bought some fresh dates, and we paid $1.50 for a sheep. Hungry travellers consider liver and fry a dish to set before a sheikh. On this occasion, however, our enjoyment was marred by the water. Even Soyer's dinners would scarcely charm if washed down with cups of a certain mineral spring found at Epsom. We started at 10 o'clock in the morning of Monday, the 5th of September, in a southeasterly direction, and travelled over a flat thinly dotted with desert vegetation. At 1 p.m. we passed a basaltic ridge, and then, entering a long, depressed line of country, a kind of valley, paced down it 5 tedious hours. The Samoom, as usual, was blowing hard, and it seemed to affect the travellers' tempers. In one place I saw a Turk who couldn't speak a word of Arabic, violently disputing with an Arab who couldn't understand a word of Turkish. The pilgrim insisted upon adding to the camel's load a few dry sticks, such as are picked up for cooking. The camel man, as perseveringly, threw off the extra burden. They screamed with rage, hustled each other, and at last the Turk dealt the Arab a heavy blow. I afterwards heard that the pilgrim was mortally wounded that night, his stomach being ripped open with a dagger. On inquiring what had become of him, I was assured that he'd been comfortably wrapped up in his shroud and placed in a half-dug grave. This is the general practice in the case of the poor and solitary, whom illness or accident incapacitates from proceeding. It's impossible to contemplate such a fate without horror. The torturing thirst of a wound, the burning sun heating the brain to madness, and, worst of all, for they don't wait till death, the attacks of the jackal, the vulture, and the raven of the wild. At 5:30 a.m. on Tuesday the 6th of September, we arose refreshed by the cool, comfortable night, and loaded the camels. We travelled towards the southeast, and entered a country destitute of the low ranges of hill which from Al-Madinah southwards had bounded the horizon. After a 2 miles' march, our camels climbed up a precipitous ridge and then descended into a broad gravel plain. This day's march was peculiarly Arabia. It was a desert peopled only with echoes, a place of death for what little there is to die in it, a wilderness where, to use my companion's phrase, there is none but Allah. Nature scalped, flayed, discovered all her skeleton to the gazer's eye. The horizon was a sea of mirage. Gigantic sand columns whirled over the plain, and on both sides of our road were huge piles of bare rock standing detached upon the surface of sand and clay. Here they appeared in oval lumps, heaped up with a semblance of symmetry. There a single boulder stood, with its narrow foundation based upon a pedestal of low, dome-shapen rock. At 6 a.m. on September the 9th, we left the Fiumara, and turning to the west, we arrived about an hour afterwards at the station. Al-Zariba, the valley, is an undulating plain amongst high granite hills. In many parts it was faintly green. Water was close to the surface, and rain stood upon the ground. During the night we travelled about 23 miles, and our present station was southeast 56 degrees from our last. Having pitched the tent and eaten and slept, we prepared to perform the ceremony of Al-Iram, assuming the pilgrim garb, as Al-Zariba is the mikat, or the appointed place. Between the noonday and the afternoon prayers, a barber attended to shave our heads, cut our nails, and trim our moustachios. Then, having bathed and perfumed ourselves, the latter is a questionable point, we donned the attire, which is nothing but two new cotton cloths, each 6 feet long by 3.5 feet broad, white, with narrow red stripes and fringes. One of these sheets, technically termed the reader, is thrown over the back and, exposing the arm and shoulder, is knotted at the right side in the style wisha. The izar is wrapped round the loins from waist to knee and, knotted or tucked in at the middle, supports itself. Our heads were bare, and nothing was allowed upon the instep. It is said that some clans of Arabs still preserve this religious but most uncomfortable costume. It's doubtless of ancient date, and to this day in the regions lying west of the Red Sea it continues to be the common dress of the people. After the toilet we were placed with our faces in the direction of Mecca and ordered to say aloud, I vow this Iram of Hajj, the pilgrimage, and the Umrah, the little pilgrimage, to Allah Almighty. Having thus performed a two-bow prayer, we repeated, without rising from the sitting position, these words. O Allah, verily I purpose the Hajj and the Umrah, then enable me to accomplish the two and accept them both of me and make both blessed to me. Followed the Talbiyat, or exclaiming, Here I am, O Allah, here am I. No partner hast thou, here am I. Verily the praise and the grace are thine and the empire. No partner hast thou, here am I. And we were warned to repeat these words as often as possible until the conclusion of the ceremonies. Then Sheikh Abdallah, who acted as director of our consciences, bade us be good pilgrims, avoiding quarrels, immorality, bad language, and light conversation. We must so reverence life that we should avoid killing game, causing an animal to fly, and even pointing it out for destruction, nor should we scratch ourselves, save with the open palm, lest vermin be destroyed, or a hair uprooted by the nail. We were to respect the sanctuary by sparing the trees, and not to pluck a single blade of grass. As regards personal considerations, we were to abstain from all oils, perfumes, and unguents, from washing the head with mallow or with lote leaves, from dyeing, shaving, cutting, or vellicating a single pile or hair, and though we might take advantage of shade and even form it with upraised hands, we must by no means cover our sconces. For each infraction of these ordinances, we must sacrifice a sheep. And it's commonly said by Muslims that none but the Prophet could be perfect in the intricacies of pilgrimage. At about 5:30 p.m., we entered a suspicious-looking place. On the right was a stony buttress along whose base the stream, when there is one, swings. And to this depression was our road limited by the rocks and thorn trees which filled the other half of the channel. The left side was a precipice, grim and barren, but not so abrupt as its brother. Opposite us, the way seemed barred by piles of hills, crest rising above crest into the far blue distance. Day still smiled upon the upper peaks, but the lower slopes and the Fiumara bed were already curtained with grey, sombre shade. A damp seemed to fall upon our spirits as we approached this valley perilous. I remarked that the voices of the women and children sank into silence, and the loud labaik of the pilgrims was gradually stilled. Whilst still speculating upon the cause of this phenomenon, it became apparent. A small curl of the smoke, like a lady's ringlet, on the summit of the right-hand precipice caught my eye, and simultaneous with the echoing crack of the matchlock, a high-trotting dromedary in front of me rolled over upon the sands. A bullet had split its heart, throwing the rider a goodly somersault to 5 or 6 yards. There ensued terrible confusion. Women screamed, children cried, and men vociferated, each one striving with might and main to urge his animal out of the place of death. But the road being narrow, they only managed to jam the vehicles in a solid, immovable mass. At every matchlock shot, a shudder ran through the huge body, as when the surgeon's scalpel touches some more sensitive nerve. The irregular horsemen, perfectly useless, galloped up and down over the stones, shouting to and ordering one another. The pasha of the army had his carpet spread at the foot of the left-hand precipice, and debated over his pipe with the officers what ought to be done. No good genius whispered crown the heights. Then it was that the conduct of the Wahhabis found favour in my eyes. They came up galloping their camels, torrents less rapid and less rash, with their elf locks tossing in the wind, and their flaring matches casting a strange lurid light over their features. Taking up a position, one body began to fire upon the Utaiba robbers, whilst 200 or 300, dismounting, swarmed up the hill under the guidance of the Sharif Zaid. I'd remarked this nobleman at Al-Madinah as a model specimen of the pure Arab. Like all Sharifs, he's celebrated for bravery, and he's killed many with his own hand. When urged at Al-Zariba to ride into Mecca, he swore that he wouldn't leave the caravan till in sight of the walls. Unfortunately for the pilgrims, he kept his word. Presently the firing was heard far in our rear, the robbers having fled. At the beginning of the skirmish, I'd primed my pistols and sat with them ready for use. But soon, seeing that there was nothing to be done and wishing to make an impression, I called aloud for my supper. Sheikh Noor, exanimate with fear, couldn't move. The boy Mohammed ejaculated only an, "Oh, sir!" And the people around exclaimed in disgust, "By Allah, he eats!" Sheikh Abdullah the Meccan, being a man of spirit, was amused by the spectacle. "Are these Afghan manners, effendim?" he inquired from the shugduf behind me. "Yes," I replied aloud. "In my country we always dine before an attack of robbers, because that gentry's in the habit of sending men to bed supperless." A day later, at about 1 a.m, I was aroused by general excitement. "Mecca! Mecca!" cried some voices. "The sanctuary! Oh, the sanctuary!" exclaimed others, and all burst into loud labaik, not unfrequently broken by sobs. I looked out from my litter and saw by the light of the southern stars the dim outlines of a large city. a shade darker than the surrounding plain. We were passing over the last ridge by a cutting called the Sanyat Kudar, the winding place of the cut. The winding path is flanked on both sides by watchtowers, which command the road leading from the north into Mecca.